Good morning and welcome, friends and peers. Let's turn to number 567 in the blue hymnal. Number 567. And let's stand together. And let's sing verses 1, 2, and 3. But on the first verse, let's start in unison on the soprano line. So let's sing verse 1 in unison and then verse 2 and 5. Verses 2 and 5 in parts.
How firm a foundation he saves of the Lord. He is laid for your faith in his excellent word. What more can we say than to you he has said, to you who forever wish to Jesus has led.
A number of years, there have been several faculty and staff administrators who have reminded us that March is National Women's History Month, and we've wanted to do something meaningful around that. I think we're still looking for that committee that's going to take it on and own it and breathe life into it. But this year, as Twyla Yoder was finishing her time and talking with some other women and also Susan, they realized this is an area of expertise for our President Susan Schultz Huxman, and the interest that you had in bringing some stories of women who persisted, pioneering women who have made a difference in the world. And our emphasis is on that today, and we're pleased that you'll be bringing that talk. Susan has served more than 25 years in higher education in a number of institutions, most recently as president of Conrad Grable University in Waterloo, Ontario, and now as our president for over 1 year, and we're very happy to hear this part of your expertise. As we are preparing ourselves for what Susan will bring, we thought about this a song in this book by John Bell. This is One is the Body. Come on up, musicians. One is the Body, Songs of Unity and Diversity. And there's a song in here entitled, we're going to hear it in a minute, There is a Line of Women. And some thoughts from John Bell about this song. For many centuries, male preachers and denominational lectionaries have conspired to prevent the stories of biblical women or illustrations from the experience of contemporary women from being heard. Thus, girls grow up in a church with few models of female discipleship, and boys presume that God's favored gender is masculine. This song reflects a few of the many stories of subversive women in the Bible. Let's hear this, and then following this song will be Dr. Huxman.
Was repressed. God she gave birth, and sing a song of Tamar, who stood for women's worth, and sing a song of Hannah, who bargained with the Lord, and sing a song of Mary, who bread and bread God's word.
There is a line of women who took on powerful men, defying laws and scruples to let life live again. And though despite their triumph, their story stayed untold, God kept their number growing, creative, strong, and bold.
So sing a song of Shipra, with Pua close at hand, engaged to kill male children, they foil the king's command. And sing a song of Rahab, who sheltered spies and lied. And sing a song of Esther, preventing genocide.
There is a line of women who stood by Jesus' side, who housed him while he ministered and held him when he died. And though they claimed he'd risen, the news was deemed suspect, till Jesus stood among them, his womanly elect.
So sing a song of Adam, who saw Christ's infant face, and sing a song of Martha, who gave him food and space, and sing of all the men
much. That was beautiful. There is a line of women. Love it. Well, good morning, EMU community, and welcome back, students, from spring break. March is many things. It is topsy-turvy weather from winter to spring. It is midterm exams, the beginning of Lent, and the celebration of International Women's Day and Women's History Month. 2017 to 2018 has been quite a year for women. And I think we can get this to go. There we go. A year of resisting, a year of reckoning, a year of rollbacks, and a year of resilience. In short, women have been on the move. It has also been a year for landmark books and movies. Some of these you may recognize, books and movies that celebrate women's accomplishments and breakthroughs, and books and movies that are tackling many, many remaining challenges. This is exactly what Women's History Month is designed to call our attention to. Women's History Month began as a local event in 1978 in Sonoma County, California, to promote the teaching of women's history. At first, it was one day, March 8th. Then, in 1981, Congress passed a resolution to make the national celebration a week-long event, and in 1987, expanded it to the full month. So, we've been intentionally focusing on women's issues now for 30 years in this country. We use the month to teach, to advocate, for change, and to celebrate women. One small slice of that advocacy work includes this. Women still earn less than men for doing the same jobs. Motherhood has long been the explanation for the persistent pay gap. A decade out of college, though, full-time working women, even those who do not have children, still make 78 cents on the male dollar in many industries and professions. As an example, you may remember that this year's Oscars Awards, where Jimmy Kimmel joked about the pay gap between men and women, even in Hollywood, using the case of Mark Wahlberg and Michelle Williams, who were actually represented by the same agent on the film All the Money in the World, somewhat ironically. The audience applauded Wahlberg for donating his out-of-proportion $1.5 million to Michelle Williams' measly per diem day to the Time's Up Legal Defense Fund. As Bella Abzug, the late witty former congresswoman from New York, once said, "Women have been told to speak softly and carry a lipstick." Those days are over. And indeed, they are over. Women are not just filling the halls of Congress, they are filling boardrooms, courtrooms, operating rooms, classrooms, cockpits, and pulpits in astounding numbers. So, as they say, we've come a long way, baby, but there's still a long way to go. And that's why we must continue to tell the stories of women. Stories help sustain us, comfort us, motivate us, and bond one generation to the next. This morning, I want to tell you three historical stories of women who, yes, persisted, who overcame huge odds to become pioneer reformers, who persevered despite resistance at every turn, who never lived to see the real reform they championed, and who spoke out or wrote about causes larger than themselves. My first story is about the first woman abolitionist crusader in the United States. Her name was Angelina Grimke. What an unlikely reformer she was. Born into privilege in 1805 in Charleston, South Carolina, to a wealthy slaveholding family, Angela had every comfort imaginable. She was the youngest of 14 kids, educated by private tutors, raised as a devout Episcopalian, doted on by her parents and siblings, and yet she was restive. She and her older sister Sarah were particularly disturbed by the practice of slavery. So even though the laws of South Carolina forbade teaching slaves to read or write, the sisters created an underground school for slaves on their own plantation. Grimke's diary describes these sessions with supreme satisfaction. She writes, "The light was put out, the keyhole screened, and flat on our stomachs, with the spelling book under our eyes, we defied the laws of South Carolina." The girls were discovered by their father and severely lectured. Rather than give up and become dutiful children, they ran away and took up residence in Philadelphia, joined the Quakers and the anti-slavery cause. While in Philadelphia, Angelina discovered public speaking, even though in the 1830s it was considered unseemly for women to speak to men in public places. In 1837, in Amesbury, Massachusetts, Angelina engaged in a series of debates on the slavery question, the very first public debates in the United States between a man and a woman. Think of that. Angelina, by the way, is the woman on your left with black hair. Though she was the youngest, she was the tallest, standing at nearly 6 foot tall. But it was a hot May evening in Philadelphia in 1838, which became Angelina's swan song in her fight for human rights. 2 days after her marriage to a fellow reformer in the anti-slavery cause, Angelina accepted an invitation to speak at the dedication of Pennsylvania Hall, a splendid gaslit structure with the motto, "Virtue, Liberty, Freedom," in gold letters carved above the stage. In publicity leading up to the event, Angelina was denounced in the newspapers by the clergy as a godless woman, a he woman, even the devil incarnate. Before the ceremonies could even unfold, an angry, howling mob formed in the streets. They threw bricks and rotten tomatoes through the windows. Calmly, Angelina arose from her seat, gazed around the large hall with such unnerving intensity, the crowd momentarily quieted. She began, "Men, brethren, and fathers, mothers, daughters, and sisters, what came ye out for to see? A reed shaken in the wind? Is it curiosity merely, or a deep sympathy with the perishing slave that has brought this large audience together?" At this, someone yelled, "Fire!" People ran. Heavy stones thudded against the windows. Angelina Grimke kept on speaking for over an hour. But later that evening, the mob burned the new hall down to the ground. Ill health forced Angelina to retire shortly after this impassioned speech. Though she raised three children, she was bedridden for years. Still, what a debt of gratitude we owe to this moral voice who dared speak out on behalf of women and slaves even 30 years before the Civil War. The second story I want to tell is of a particularly colorful feminist pioneer. For those of you worried about getting a late start on a career, I would encourage you to take note. This feminist pioneer didn't graduate from high school until the age of 23 and didn't discover her true vocation until the age of 39. I also would say to any student considering to be a minister, a doctor, a lobbyist, or a comedian that they owe a debt of gratitude to this woman. Her name was Anna Howard Shaw. Anna grew up in the wilderness of Michigan, barely eking out an existence with her mother and three younger siblings from 1850 to 1873. She left for Boston at the age of 27 to become a social worker. Here she worked with underprivileged children, 18 of whom she would call my children throughout her life, even though she never married or had children of her own. She entered Boston University Theological School to become an ordained Methodist minister. And there, she experienced the sting of discrimination in especially damaging ways. Shaw's class consisted of herself and 42 men. Men were given free dormitory accommodations. Anna had to rent a small attic room with no heat or running water. Here she lived, literally near starvation the rest of the school year. Her commitment to school understandably wavered, but fate intervened. The superintendent of the Women's Missionary Society admired Anna's pluck and offered her $3.50 a week. She graduated, becoming the very first woman to be ordained a Methodist preacher in the United States. Unable to find a post as a female minister, Anna embarked on a new career as a medical doctor and earned her physician's license in 1885. Again, she met resistance, unable to find a client base. So at the age of 39, she gave these professions up to become a full-time paid professional speaker for the women's rights movement in their fight for the right to vote. And for the next 40 years, Anna Howard Shaw broke all the rules for how women were to behave in public. She confounded those that said women were godless who stepped outside of their world of hearth and home by wearing her ministerial gowns in public, always finding a sympathetic minister, usually Methodist, to introduce her as the Reverend Anna Howard Shaw. She confounded those that said women were too frail to endure the rough and tumble world of politics by literally setting speaking records. She spoke in every American state and in many European countries. She delivered several hundred speeches a year and often spoke as many as 8 times a day for women's suffrage. In 1915, for example, she made 204 speeches in New York State alone. She confounded those that said women rights activists were shrill and humorless by becoming a first-class entertainer. Long before Oprah, she interacted with audiences. Here are two examples from her speeches where audiences were skeptical for why women would want to vote. And she'd ask them to write down their questions on little cards, and she'd pick them up. And so here's a sampling. Here's a question. It's speculated that even if women get the vote, they would not use it. Anna's response? Well, if we would not use it, then I really cannot see the harm of giving it to us. We would not hurt anybody with it, and what an easy way for you men to get rid of us. Here's another question. But if women get the right to vote, they will have to sit on juries. Anna's answer? I have seen some juries that ought to be sat on. And I have seen some women that would be glad to sit on anything. And so it goes, one-liner after one-liner, effectively disarming her audience resistance and diffusing the charges against suffrage by playing the entertainer role to perfection. Well, after speaking over 10,000 times on behalf of suffrage, her reputation blossomed. Newspapers called her brilliant, queen of the platform, even the foremost orator of her generation. Leaders of the women's suffrage movement concluded this: Anna Howard Shaw won more people for equal suffrage than any other advocate. Unfortunately, she never saw the 19th Amendment enacted into law. She died 9 months before the amendment was passed in 1920, giving women the right to vote after a 72-year social movement struggle. And in typical fashion, she died of overwork after a particularly grueling speaking tour in Indiana. My third and final story is about an especially courageous woman. Long before Rosa Parks made history for not giving up her seat on a bus to a white passenger, this black woman did the same. Long before investigative journalism became typical in this country, this woman practiced it. And while we may remember that W.E.B. Du Bois helped establish the NAACP, we may forget that this woman was its co-founder. Ida B. Wells was her name. She was born in Holly Springs, Mississippi, in 1862. Both of her parents were slaves. Yet after emancipation, it looked like Ida would have a promising, even comfortable life. Her parents continued to work for their former master, only now for good pay. She attended a top-flight school for freed slaves, reading all the books in the library before the age of 15. But then tragedy struck. Both her parents died in a yellow fever epidemic within 24 hours of each other, her baby sister too. And so at the age of 16, Ida was left in charge of her four siblings, age 13, 11, 9, and 5. She got a teaching job in Memphis to support her brothers and sister by passing a rigorous teaching exam and claiming to be 18. While teaching, Ida became a writer for the Memphis Free Speech newspaper. Her investigative slant began after an ugly experience with Jim Crow laws. Wells boarded a train in Memphis, seating herself in the ladies' coach, the first class car. She began to read. She was surprised, however, when the conductor coming by to collect tickets refused to accept hers. Brusquely, he told her to move to the car behind, which was reserved for smokers and blacks. Ida refused to move. Angered by her defiance, the conductor grabbed her arm to drag her out, but Ida bit him and braced herself. He called for reinforcements. It took three men to pry Wells loose and to push her out of the coach. When she tumbled down the steps, her white fellow passengers jeered and stood up and clapped. Ida later wrote in her diary, "I returned to my home with the sound of that applause still echoing in my ears. I was humiliated." Ida did not let the incident pass. She hired a lawyer and sued the railroad for damages. She won and was awarded $500. which was a lot in those days. The Jim Crow event energized her writing career, and soon she was asked to join the staff of the Memphis Free Press, and in the summer of 1889, managed to buy a 1/3 interest in the paper. Shortly thereafter, tragedy struck again. One of her best friends was lynched. For Ida, the lynching meant more than the loss of a friend. She said, "It changed the whole course of my life. When no attempt was made to punish the murderer, I used my column to instigate an economic boycott and a mass exodus of Memphis. In 2 months' time, 6,000 black people left Memphis with me and my brothers and sisters." Ida went to New York. Here she went on a journalistic rampage to end lynchings. She documented systematically the number of lynchings in the United States, resulting in the book entitled The Red Record. As her anti-lynching campaign escalated, so did the criticism and the danger. Her paper was destroyed by a mob. She was threatened. A fellow journalist and lawyer, Ferdinand Barnett, came to her aid. They married and had 4 children. Together in Chicago, they used their newspaper to fight for equal rights. After a 15-year hiatus from activism, as Ida said, to do God's work of raising children, she returned to activism, hardly missing a beat, co-founding the NAACP with W.E.B. Du Bois and leading the first black women's suffrage club. Upon her passing in 1931, newspapers across the country voiced, "Ida B. Wells has shaken this country like an earthquake." Well, these are some of the stories and some of the historical challenges that existed in the women's quest for equality. And they are stories that remind us why we must continue to recognize Women's History Month, honor those that came before us, and energize and challenge those that will lead us into the future. From the inspiration of an Angelina Grimke, Anna Howard Shaw, and Ida B. Wells, may we all come to know, or better yet, nurture, a feminist pioneer for our times. Together, let's continue to make women's history. Thank you.
Thank you, Dr. Huxman. I imagine we would love to hear more stories, and not just from you, but others. So let's continue to empower and encourage one another by learning from history, from amazing people. So again, in closing, from the song from John Bell, "There is a line of women extending back to Eve, whose role in shaping history God only could conceive. And though through endless ages their witness was repressed, God valued and encouraged them, through whom the world was blessed." Let's carry these stories with us and make our own as well. Go in peace.